All right, welcome to the Cava Ships podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervella.
The Cava Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is one of the largest artificial intelligence and machine learning federal contractors to the U.S. government. HII delivering the advantage.
Coming up, it was a great week at the Navy League's Sea, Air, and Space Symposium at National Harbor. We had the chance to see so many good friends, meet some of our many listeners, and talk to leaders in uniform and across industry. This week, we bring highlights from three interviews we conducted on the show floor. In our first interview, we talked to Kim Ernson, President, Naval Power at Raytheon, which is an RTX business. Without further ado, here's that conversation.
All right, we're here at Sea Air Space with Kim Ernson. She is the president of Raytheon's Naval Power business. Welcome back to the podcast, Ms. Ernson.
Always good to be here. Thank you for having me today.
So you are involved in some of the key programs at Raytheon, including the SPY-6 radar, and of course the standard missile family of missiles. Let's start with standard missiles, since that's been on people's minds all this recent months with action in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, the expenditure of missiles. Mm-hmm. Primarily, the U.S. Navy's been using SM-2 missiles, and those are not missiles still in production for the U.S. Navy anymore. I think you're still making those.
Yes.
For foreign navies, is that correct?
That is correct. And to your point, I mean, obviously, you know, as we've watched what's been transpiring in the Red Sea, we're working very closely with the Navy to make sure that we're learning as quickly as we can on what's being deployed. To your point, we've seen Standard Missile 2s and 6s launched. We've seen Tomahawks. And, of course, we do everything from that close-in ship self-defense, so things like a Phalanx system all the way out to RAM and ESSM. All of those capabilities have been deployed here over the last several months. And so while we don't like to see conflict, it definitely, you know, reinvigorates the why we do what we do, to make sure that, one, we have free trade across the oceans and that our men and women in uniform are safe.
So at the moment, people have been worried about the procurement of weapon systems and in particular missiles for a long time. Mm-hmm. This isn't something that's just popped up recently, but it's been more of a focus. Recently, more people have been thinking about it.
Right.
This is not just a question of throwing money at something. So we want more SM-6 missiles. The budget is increasing, but it takes time to put these missiles together, right? Well, I think the rule of thumb that I heard a couple years ago was about 3 years for a full all-up round from the point you order it. You have to order these long lead components. Can you just discuss what's involved in delivering an all-up round missile
Sure.
from the point of order?
Sure. To your point, I mean, obviously, you know, we continually look at how we can improve our lead times. Over the last couple of years, as we've seen the resultants of the pandemic play out, we have seen increased lead times, particularly in key components such as microelectronics, which go into, you know, as we always call it, the eyes and ears of the missiles. A lot of those microelectronics are placed onto cards that do a lot of the complex, you know, understanding of the environment the missile is flying in. And then the second typically longest lead item is the rocket motors. Another key critical element, subsystem that has to go into missiles. And so, you know, the more we have insight into what our demand signal is coming from our Navy customer, and in this case, they've been doing a much better job of giving us that insight, we can then turn around and work with those key sub-tier suppliers that really have those long lead items and work to try to bring those back in and try to go out ahead of when we can get the contract to try to get the full-up, all-up round to the Navy as fast as we can.
SM-6 is becoming a multi-mission, multi-capable weapon of choice. It does anti-air, it does anti-surface. If you ramped up production to the maximum point,
right,
whatever that is, even then, what sort of a minimum time that you would need to deliver a missile?
Well, so right now, just First, I'll talk about the capacity. Right now, we are executing about 100 a year, and we have been partnering, because obviously SM6 is one of our top priority programs for Raytheon. We know the criticality of the capability it brings to the Navy and why the Navy wants it so bad. So we currently are under contract to do about 100 a year, and we are working with the Navy to increase that production capacity, not only in our facilities, but also in our sub-tier suppliers so that we can get up to 200, with ultimately 300 out in about 5 years. So that is an activity we're actively doing right now. But back to your point, I mean, right now we're continuing to look at how we can expedite, decrease our cycle time and throughput, particularly in some of the complex subassemblies that we do inside of our factory. We've seen a great increase over the last couple of years about our, you know, monthly cadence on being able to produce those. A lot of effort's been going into streamlining the testing, improving the yields, those kinds of things, again, all with the intent to get capability out faster.
Is 18 months at a very high rate of production out of the picture or possible?
No. I think 18 months to 24 months is, you know, again, depending on the complexity of the product. SM6 certainly is very complex, like a Tomahawk. ESSM and RAM tend to be a little bit, you know, less complex, and so you can, you know, look at improving those timelines.
Let's move to ballistic missile defense.
Sure.
So you have variants of SM2 and SM3 that are used in different regimes mm-hmm. of ballistic missile defense. There was just a recent FTM test again. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss the most recent test?
Yeah, so we recently did FTM 32. I would offer that MDA needs to officially give any comments as it relates to that test. You know, the reason we do testing is to learn. We had great success on the Standard Missile 6 event, and we're continuing to work through, you know, other things that we learned and observed during the test.
A component of that test, not the direct point of it, was the USS Jack Lucas, mm-hmm. DDG-125, which is the first Flight 3 ship, the first ship fitted with a Spy 6 radar.
Right.
This has just begun the earliest stages of IOT&E as mm-hmm. an initial test and evaluation. There were some problems in that particular system. One of the reasons you do testing and evaluation is because you're looking for things, how well they work. Can you just address some of those issues?
Well, again, I'll direct you to MDA for any official commentary on the FTM 32 test event. However, you know, that's why, to your point, we do testing, right? We test because it helps us learn how our systems are performing. SPY 6 is, you know, an advancement of capability for the Navy. The feedback we're getting from the use and the exercises that we're doing on the ship is all positive. The sailors love it. Obviously, the capability it brings to them about how far they can see and all of those kinds of things is eye-watering. And so, you know, getting an event where we can get some knowledge points is always very informative to us, allows us to go back and help inform and improve the algorithms that are, you know, the behind-the-scenes activity that makes that system work as well as it does.
And the first Spy 6, I think it's V2, the rotator.
Yes.
Is now on the Richard M. McCool, which
Correct.
Is about to be delivered from Huntington Ingalls.
Yep.
That's the first ship with that. The variants of that radar, the rotator, It's a smaller version of the large fixed array mm-hmm. that goes on the Flight 3 destroyers. But this is going on a number of ships, amphibious ships, carrier. Mm-hmm. This is actually a big deal all by itself.
It really is. I mean, when we designed the Spy 6 radar, the whole intent was to have a scalable design. So when you look at the backbone of the radar, they're the radar modular assemblies, RMAs. And so to your point, you know, the large one that's on DDG-125 is 37 RMAs in one face. And then obviously you have four faces on the ship. The rotator and the fixed ESR variant, which brings in that air traffic control capability, is the first one being tested right now on that rotator, as you said, for LPD-29. That starts to bring in that added capability for the ability to carry and handle the air traffic activity that has to happen on the top of the ship. Really excited about the work that's been going on there. Obviously, it's the integration into the baseline 12, the combat management system. We have such a great partnership between ourselves and Lockheed Martin and, you know, the shipyard, and in this case, Huntington Ingalls, to really ensure that we are working through the paces of getting it integrated, starting that initial testing, and making sure we can get it out and get it deployed.
All right, let's move to something else, directed energy.
Mm-hmm.
So focus, actually, from the beginning of this year, from the new commander of the U.S. Naval Surface Forces
mm-hmm.
about where are my lasers. I want more, you know, the whole actions in the Red Sea against both unmanned aerial systems and unmanned surface systems and other weapons have brought in more of a focus about what's happened to that. There used to be a big emphasis about it. People talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. It's kind of driven, kind of fallen back as some of the realities of the real world have settled in. Where is Raytheon now on directed energy systems?
Absolutely. It's a great point. I mean, we do know that all of our customers, and particularly the Navy, is going to need a combination of both kinetic and non-kinetic effects. And so one of the things that we're heavily focused in on is high-powered microwaves, really leveraging that capability and technology and the scalability we see that it has to really be a significant game changer for the Navy. We have a contract right now that we're working with them on really looking at how we can take something that has been proven for a land-based system and really taking it and scaling it down so that it has the size, weight, and power capability to go onto a ship and be applicable. We think there's a lot of transferability of that technology, and we're really excited about how we can bring that to the forefront and, again, provide the customers with another layer of defense between that kinetic and non-kinetic effect.
Hypersonics.
Yes.
Where's Raytheon in hypersonics? Even at this show, some people have rolled out some developmental hypersonic weapon systems, not necessarily with a lot of fanfare. They're here, they're with presentation.
Right.
They're being presented, but not look at our cool new hypersonic. Where are you on that?
We have quite a few hypersonic activities that we're involved in. Currently, we're supporting the proposal efforts for the glide phase interceptor, the GPI, which is what many, both the MDA and Navy, will say is one of their key pursuits from a hypersonics perspective. We think we've got incredible capability and technology to really stay on the advanced timeline that the customer wants to have on that. We're also going after things like NGI, Next Generation Interceptor, and then there's some other, classified programs that we continue to support inside of that whole domain space of hypersonics. Obviously, there's a piece of it on the effector side, but then we're also working on that entire kill chain at the Raytheon level. So how we make sure the sensors, the overhead sensors, all of that network has the ability to make sure that from a hypersonics, you can see it, but then you can also direct your capability out there.
I can't not address the branding issue.
Oh,
so
yeah.
RTX. I sort of missed the major announcement. It's at some point somebody was talking about Raytheon and said, well, it's not Raytheon anymore, it's RTX. Apparently, though, no, you're still using the Raytheon name. Can you just explain the breakdown now? RTX is there are ads everywhere, mm-hmm. hockey games, not just here. And RTX is a new entity. It's just some letters. What is it?
Sure. So RTX stands for Raytheon Technology Corporation, and it really is a brand or a family of brands. When you look at what transpired during the merger in 2020, it was Heritage UTC forming with Heritage Raytheon. And inside that umbrella are really three iconic brands. You had Collins, which does a lot of commercial applications. They do everything from avionics to interiors to brakes to landing gear, and they also have military applications. Then we have Pratt & Whitney, an icon in the engine world, right? They've been delivering commercial engines for 90, 100 years, and obviously they do the F-135 engines, so a huge family of products there. And then we have Raytheon. And so last year, in July of 2023, we decided we really wanted to, really highlight and focus on those three iconic brands, and hence why we went back to just calling it Raytheon. When we did the merger almost 4 years ago now, we had two entities of Raytheon. We've combined all of those into one, and we just put it under the Raytheon umbrella. So it's good to be, leveraging just that Raytheon brand, because it in and of itself in the defensive world is very iconic. We're, heavily known here in the domestic customer set that we have for all the capabilities that we bring, and we have a huge footprint internationally. So it's really good to be leveraging our brand recognition again.
So it's not incorrect to still use Raytheon?
Nope.
I mean, you're still very much a Raytheon.
We are Raytheon. Yes, we're Raytheon, a business of RTX.
A special thanks to Ms. Ernson and her entire team for that great conversation. In interview number two, we talked to retired Navy captain and career surface warfare officer Tate Westbrook of BAE Systems. Here's our discussion.
All right, we're back at SNA. We're joined by Tate Westbrook of BAE. Tate, thank you for joining us. We are going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about some lessons out of the Red Sea and things that BAE is working with the Navy on. You did a brief earlier today. Why don't you just start off with the type of technology and the type of work that you're doing for the Navy, what you're telling them and what you're hearing from them?
Sure. Thank you very much, and appreciate your time today, and thanks for coming to Sierra Space. I am a retired Navy captain, surface warfare officer, former Commodore. This mission is very close to me personally because of my experience at sea over a 28-year career. And one of the things I was always concerned about is the asymmetric threat, including one-way attack drones or short-range anti-ship missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles. U.S. Navy, as we've seen for months now, since October, has been challenged along with our allies with those threats, and the Navy is concerned and has expressed to industry they need help with increasing the lethality and survivability of their ships, doing it in a way that has very large volume capacity, and doing it in a way that is lower cost per engagement. The Secretary of the Navy, during the Sierra Space Conference this week, reminded everyone that the cost exchange that some ships have been doing of spending a $2.1 million standard missile on a far less expensive drone threat is an unsustainable cost exchange, and we believe several of the products that BAE Systems brings to the fight will solve the Navy's that trifecta of problems.
So let's talk about some of those systems, if you don't mind. Can you run through, you know, some of the things that you are sharing with Navy and that you're showing at the conference?
Sure. At Sierra Space 24, we're featuring the hypervelocity projectile. This is a low-drag, aerodynamic, precision-guided maneuvering munition fitted for the Mark 45 5-inch gun that BAE Systems also produces. We have been developing this projectile with the U.S. Navy and with the Office of Secretary of Defense Strategic Capabilities Office, SCO, since 2012. That we believe after over 100 tests against threat representative targets, cruise missiles, and drone-like targets, that this system is now ready for employment in the fleet in the 5-inch gun.
As you say, you've been developing this for a long time. It's been shown here at the show for a long time. I've done some stuff on it in years past. What makes it effective now? Has there been a breakthrough? Is it just a general maturity of the whole system? Why is this working now?
It has been working, and we've fired it from both 155 millimeter cannons as well as 5-inch guns from land-based guns as well as from the USS Dewey during RIMPAC 2018. So it is a proven capability. It is certainly technologically developmental. However, we are not saying there's a significant breakthrough that's changed. It's that the Navy has come to us with that trifecta of challenges, wanting more lethal, greater capacity, and lower cost per engagement. And they, as you say, they have seen it at previous trade shows in the past, and I'm pleased that we are in ongoing discussions with the Navy on how to rapidly bring that to the fleet now because of what's happening in the Red Sea.
I'm not trying to beat it, but because it's been around for a long time, so essentially you're talking the requirements have changed, have become more urgent for this weapon than they were in the past. The Navy was trying to develop similar weapons for many, many years. The 155 wasn't always a problem. Getting that 155 technology into a 127 5-inch made a big difference. That was a big challenge.
Well, I mean, that really wasn't the challenge.
No?
Because the projectile is common, and you see there displayed, the projectile is common in its size and mass and many common components. The difference is the SABO, the package that is outside of the round for a 155 cannon. The SABO is 155 millimeter in diameter. As soon as it fires, the SABO pedals peel off and fall away, and the projectile that continues to the target is identical in shape and mass. And so there's going to be efficiency across the joint force if both Army and Navy increase the production and demand signal for hypervelocity projectile.
What would have to change from a training or from a sustainment, or you know, what has to change to be able to make this happen?
From a tactical standpoint, the concept of layered defense is alive and well in the surface Navy. BAE Systems owns many aspects of layered defense, from the farthest missile ranges into the close-in systems. This will effectively be a precision-guided solution for that medium-range engagement, and minor modifications to the gun are all that is needed. We are have designed this to incorporate in the ship's existing combat systems on a U.S. Navy destroyer to both minimize time for fielding and minimize the cost of total integration in the combat system.
We've had a couple former Commodores, we've had a couple former CEOs come on and talk about layered defense and detect to engage. Would this be, you know, you have this projectile, the system would then, based upon the incoming target or incoming threat, it would choose, hey, I want to use that projectile instead of the longer term or longer range missile in this case. Can you talk a little bit about how that would change?
Sure. As a former surface warfare officer, I'm not going to get deep into the Navy's tactical mindset. However, the idea that a destroyer only has 96 missile cells, and despite recent efforts, the U.S. Navy still cannot reload missiles at sea underway, unlike 5-inch projectiles where they replenish at sea every day. The change in tactical mindset will be, instead of for a lesser threatening threat set, wait a little bit and then engage with the 5-inch gun and its proven capabilities, whether it's with conventional munitions, air defense munitions, or with hypervelocity projectile. And the choice in doing that will allow commanding officers to preserve the much more exquisite performance of a standard missile or evolved SeaSparrow missile.
Can I ask, is BAE offering anything new in directed energy?
We are offering a high-powered microwave system, currently under contact to develop that for a Department of Defense customer. We aren't featuring it at this show this year, but during Surface Navy Association, the Surface Force Commander Swoboss stated that directed energy was the way of the future. The Navy has invested significantly in lasers. However, I believe they are beginning to realize that time on target required for individual engagements with lasers is an increasing challenge, and the physics of laser performance at sea in high volume engagements is a challenge. BAE Systems' high-powered microwave system, in contrast, offers rapid changing threat response and the ability to encounter and defeat multiple threats simultaneously.
So at this time, just that one system, you don't have anything else in development that's
We're currently under contract to develop that that prototype now, and we've repeatedly offered that to the Navy as an option for defending ships and the strike group.
So before we let you go, you guys have a couple other things on the stand that kind of fit into this. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We are also offering the Navy a shorter range option, which will effectively marry two proven counter UAS systems. The BAE Systems Advanced Precision Kill Weapon System, or APKWS rocket, and our Mark 38 gun weapon system that is currently installed. We have over 400 Mark 38 Mod 3 guns across the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard. We are in discussions with the U.S. Navy to essentially merge those two systems to mount an APKWS rocket launcher on the side of our Mark 38 gun system to be able to deploy on the ships with the Mark 38, many to choose from, to defend those ships with yet another layer of layered defense. So just in the Mark 38 alone, they would have that medium range APKWS rocket, and then at closer range, either the 25 millimeter or 30 millimeter cannon that's available in the Mark 38 Mod 3.
And that guy, the Mark 38 is something pretty familiar. Just about anybody, any surface ship person, just about everybody has got at least two.
Correct.
For any deployment. So that would be a pretty easy add.
Correct. And we've, you know, we've been improving that Mark 38 system over the years. We've been producing a counter UAS upgrade kit for the Navy, and the Navy's buying those and installing them. And we also offer a counter air plus version with higher elevation and larger ammunition magazines. So that gives the Navy a range of options to upgrade the Mark 38 Mod 3 for counter UAS.
A special thank you to retired Captain Westbrook for his time at SNA, as well as to the BAE Systems team for making the interview possible. And finally, we had the opportunity to talk to George Whittier, the Chief Executive Officer of Fairbanks Morse Defense. Here are some highlights from our conversation with the CEO.
With us now is George Whittier. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Fairbanks Morse Defense. Fairbanks Morse is one of those companies that you don't hear an awful lot about all the time. So, but everybody's heard about the supply chain. And we talk about all these shipbuilding programs and all these industrial programs with the Navy. And there are the primes that people hear about all the time. And then there's that darn supply chain. We're having supply chain issues, on and on. Well, one of those key supply chain companies is Fairbanks Morse. Fairbanks Morse makes a lot of things that go into ships. They don't make the ships themselves, but they make a lot of, an awful lot of components. They do blowers and fans and pumps, and they're probably best known, more famous for engines, diesel engines in particular. So we'd like to hear about that. George, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Chris. Really glad to be here.
This is exciting. So right now, I think the latest thing I heard you talking about was medium speed diesel engines. It's not a concept that just, you know, flips out of people's minds, but it's important. What's the issue? What are you worried about? You make a lot of diesel engines. They're all in different classes. I think people might be surprised to find out that you don't make nearly as many diesel engines a year these days as people might think you do.
Yeah, so Chris, we've been making diesel engines for the Navy for almost 100 years. We can track the first one back to 1926. We may have made one before that, but we don't know for sure. In the early 1980s, there were six companies making medium-speed diesel engines in the United States, and we're the last man standing. Most of those have gone out with the death of commercial shipbuilding in the United States. A lot of those companies didn't survive. We had relatively early or kind of consistently been somewhat tied to the Navy for our business, and then that model has kept us through. But a lot of those companies are just gone. From a production standpoint, we make about 20 engines per year, and we have about seven different kinds of engines that we make, which if anyone knows much about manufacturing, knows that that's terrible, right? We're only making 2 to 3 of each kind per year, which means it's a very manual, non-efficient process. There's no assembly line. There's no real way to get economies of scale. The concern that we have with this business going forward is that the shift of the Navy from kind of more or fewer bigger ships to a more smaller ship profile means they won't need as many medium-speed diesel engines. So while we still have to be here, the aircraft carrier program, for example, has 4 backup diesel engines. The last aircraft carrier will be built in, 2045? So those have Fairbanks Morse engines on them. They have to be specified. We're going to have to be in business for at least that long, plus the 40-year life after to maintain and take care of that. So we have a 2085 kind of business model as we look out here in 2025. And so that business has to then be healthy, which means there has to be some level of regular demand to support it.
What ships are you on right now? You said aircraft carriers. Are you on the frigates? Are you on destroyers? Are you on amphib programs? Where are you?
Yeah, the biggest programs that we have today are aircraft carriers, the amphibs, both the large decks and the medium deck. So, you know, the LHA, LHD, as well as LPD, and then the oilers, the ESBs, all of the NASCO type ships. We are not on a DDG. They use gas turbines, so they don't use. However, DDGX, it looks like we'll be using engines for electric power. That program is at least 2032. George's opinion is it'll probably be delayed from that. I don't see it coming in. I think it'll be pushed out.
No.
Oh, So that's a little bit of a concern. The Navy's building fewer of these bigger ships as they make more smaller ships, and that's a long-term challenge for the business.
You guys rebranded a few years ago to kind of capture the totality of everything that you do. Let's talk about beyond engines. What else is Fairbanks Morris working on for the Navy and for other parts of the government?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most people know us, as we've been talking about, as an engine supplier. Again, that's 100 and something year history, 150 years that we've been making them. We actually made the first engine, gasoline engine, in the United States in 1893. So we've been making engines for a long, long time. About 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, the company, we used to be a forgotten part of a big public company, and we went private. And when we went private, we said, hey, what are we really? Are we an engine company, or are we a supplier to the United States Navy and the United States Coast Guard? And we said, this is what we are, the latter. And when we went on that path, we've now made 13 acquisitions, as Chris said in his opening remarks. And so we have the weapons elevator, for example, on CVN. We have valves on submarines. We have motors and controllers, cranes, all sorts of electrical hardware and doors, davits, which are, you know, safety of life at sea, critical. So we have a huge variety of different products. And what the way that we go to market is we coordinate all of that effort, and then we work with the shipyard directly. So we'll start with an engine, or we'll start with something significant, and then we specify products in as we go.
Chris, in his intro, talked about the supply chain, of which you guys play a key role in the programs that you just mentioned. Can we talk a little bit about some of those supply chain, I say issues, that's kind of pejorative, I don't mean it that way. What are your concerns, or what are your challenges as a important supply chain contributor?
The biggest challenge by far, and I would be surprised if other folks didn't agree with me on this, is making sure that there is steady, consistent level demand from the administration, from the Navy, so that we know what ships we're going to be building and when, so that we can pre-order and pre-position material and labor accordingly. The challenges that we end up having are when we don't know if we're going to be building something, or, you know, for example, what's going on with the amphib program? Are we going to build a LHA-11, or are we going to stop at LHA-10? It's hard to believe we won't build an 11, but who really can take that risk ahead of time? And we don't have necessarily really clear guidance from the Navy and the administration on that. LPD is another example. We know that we're going to get up to, I think, 33, but are they really going to build up to maybe 39? And if that's the case, and it's announced, that's a significant relief for us, and then we can plan material. But today, the biggest challenges we have are uncertainty around what the demand signal is. So the current budget from the administration is for 2025, only has 6 new ships in it. And I mean, it's kind of a shocking number for a low number. I think they're decommissioning 19 and they're going to add 6 new. Now, granted, it takes time to build those ships, but for all of the rhetoric and discussion in the world today about the dangers that we have in the Red Sea, and potentially something in China with Taiwan, to then come turn around and say, hey, we're only going to build 6 ships, it's a mismatch. And so that's probably one of the biggest challenges that I'm looking at right now, is business may actually contract. And where we're talking about, and there's so much discussion around the need for, I think it's 10,000 more workers to build submarines. At the same time, we have some of these programs that may end up declining, and we could actually lose labor in the industry, which would be a catastrophe if that actually happened.
Thank you to Mr. Whittier and his entire team for setting up our conversation.
Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vago Maradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support. The Cavas Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII, delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavas Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavas. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.